Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tax Crime Junkies. We got a good one for you today and are unpacking the details of a fraudster known as Roger Stadmuller. It features fraud, misstating your financial condition on loan applications, a family business, and hanging on by a literal thread. This is yet another example of a guy who clearly committed crimes in our field. And we're going to talk about the nitty-gritty of the case while also sharing how to avoid ending up like Roger Stadmuller. Well, let's dive in. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tax Crime Junkies, the podcast about true tax crimes. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist. I have an interest in true crimes. I have a degree in law, and I lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Thanks, Dominique. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I'm admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a non-attorney. I'm a tax instructor. And like you, I have a real interest in true crime. So we decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries and whodunits. We are the Tax Crime Junkies. So I'm excited. This is a good one. We're building some momentum right now. We're a few episodes in. We really appreciate the support from colleagues, friends, and family. And we're really grateful people are choosing to spend time listening to these tax crimes we just enjoy covering.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We genuinely appreciate it, everyone, and we hope this one is another episode that not only entertains, but also educates. With that being said, Tom, have you heard about the tax fraudster who got caught in Spokane, Washington?
Not until today. Tell us a little bit about the story, Dominique.
Well, a certified public accountant by the name of Roger Stadmuller, who was sentenced to prison for falsifying his own corporate income tax returns.
Well, that's sad for him. It's disappointing for our profession. What did he do exactly?
So Roger owned a one-stop shop accounting firm that offered services like tax preparation, bookkeeping, financial auditing. We've seen this before. He also owned a corporate entity called Zazz, Inc., and that operated his firm. And so even though Stadmuller prepared corporate tax returns for clients during this three-year period in question that we're going to look at, he eventually admitted that he filed false and fraudulent tax returns for his accounting practice. So during the years 2006 to 2008, Roger primarily got his income from doing FHA audits and federal income tax returns for third parties. So let's review a little history here, because if we go back to 2009, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, those entities or organizations provide insurance on mortgages on single-family and multifamily homes. And there was a big change in 2009. You know, we had the big peak and the crash in the real estate market, and it was announced that there were changes to the credit policy requiring mortgage bankers to submit audited annual financial statements to the FHA and to undergo an audit of their compliance with HUD requirements. What's interesting about this, Tom, is that we had this big major economic event, right? In 2008, the housing market gets completely shaken up. We're on the brink of economic disaster. I mean, we actually had economic disaster. We had banks failing. We had runs on the bank. We had long historical firms going under. And in 2009, the rules get relaxed.
Right.
So we have Housing and Urban Development and the FHA. And in 2009, the rules now say you don't need to undergo an audit for compliance with those requirements. So because Stadmuller's business has this decline in clients because he was doing FHA audits. If you're a CPA and you're losing the majority of your clients, what do you do when you want to get more revenue?
Get more clients?
Well, that's one way to do it. So Stadmuller did just that, and he hired a telemarketing firm to help him increase his revenues. Here he is talking about his practice in 2013.
I was interested in increasing my annual income and then having a practice that's worth more value than what I started with. For about $480,000 to $530,000. Well, we really didn't do too much marketing before. Prior to 2010, we had a niche that we were filling, mainly a lot of audit work, 200 audit clients a year, and there were government audits which went away. The government no longer required these particular clients to have their audited financials each year. So when that went away, we needed something to fill that niche.
In fact, the telemarketing was really successful for Roger. He brought in an extra $100,000 in 10 weeks. Wow. Not bad.
No.
The government noted in their investigation that understating his gross receipts was not merely an oversight or a failure to pay necessary attention to his own tax returns because he was way too busy handling the demands on his business. Nope. Government says it was plain old greed.
Well, to be honest, greed is a driver of a lot of the crimes we cover on this podcast, Dominique.
Yes. Well, it is one of the seven deadly sins. The government noted that he understated his income by about $1.8 million during 2006 to 2008 so that he could subsidize his luxury lifestyle by avoiding paying those federal income taxes.
That's a big understatement. And he's a CPA, so frankly, he should have known. And hey, 2006 to 2008, that was before the FHA changed the requirements. So he was understating even before he purportedly lost all this other business. Here's an email shown as evidence in his case obtained through a search warrant. Quote, "This year I will clear $1 million. I have every toy in the box anyone would want. If you don't take the time to play with your toys, you're doing something wrong." And in fact, he was falsifying a lot of documents, Dominique, to get those toys. In 2008, he submitted a loan application to Brett's RV and Marine for the purchase of getting a 2008 Fleetwood mobile home. Now, he showed much higher income, of course, and I'm sure you're not surprised, he showed an income tax return that was different than the one he actually filed with the IRS.
It's a common tactic amongst our stories, Tom.
It is. And this type of evidence clearly shows he knew what his true income was. And don't forget, when you sign things like a home loan application or other type of debt, requests for debt, it's going to include a jurat where you're generally signing that document or that application under penalty of perjury.
And then there goes another crime, right? Because now you've perjured yourself. It's like once you hit the crime slopes, it's all downhill as the charges rack up. Didn't he also track his income pretty closely too?
Yeah, and that's another factor used by the IRS to indicate he had intent and he had awareness of the fraud that he was attempting to perpetrate. They noted that not only did he have total control over his QuickBooks file, but he used some sort of envelope and handwritten notes method of tracking his income.
Intent. That's what you said. That's a key word here because that's what makes this a crime versus an oversight. You know, I imagine, Tom, that it's not too unusual for accountants to get caught up in the busyness of taking care of their clients, and often our own tax returns are filed last.
Yes,
agreed. What's that saying? You know, the cobbler's children have no shoes. And often people who are skilled at a particular trade or profession neglect to use their skills or provide services for themselves or their own family. In other words, somebody may be so busy working for their clients or customers that they may neglect their own needs or those of their loved ones. And I can imagine it's easy to say, well, I just got busy and I didn't file those tax returns, or I was confused and I filed them wrong.
I can see that for a little bit of money, but for this much, you know, and yes, we often as tax professionals put ourselves last. But Dominique, you and I talk about this all the time. We have to prioritize ourselves, right? And prioritize our business. And in fact, we're required as licensed tax professionals to be fully compliant with our own tax filing requirements. Circular 230, which guides our ethical obligations as tax professionals, requires us to be in compliance with federal tax filing obligations. And a federal tax compliance check and a suitability check can be done for whether it's an enrolled agent license, in order to e-file returns. And so this compliance check will look at, did somebody file all their individual returns? Did they file all their business returns? Did you pay all your tax? If you haven't, do you have an arrangement to pay your tax? But the honest truth is, I don't think Mr. Stadmuller was really interested in rule following anyway. He actually had CPA licenses suspended in not just one state, in California, Texas, Arizona, Oregon, and Washington.
That's strange. You don't often see that. I know you can practice in other states, particularly when we talk about federal tax, right? It's not non-state specific. But another interesting fact, Tom, is that Roger's father, Albert, was also a CPA. And in fact, he founded the family CPA firm in 1980, but Albert actually got his start in 1960. So Roger was actually joining a thriving business, and he joined the family business in 1992, and he worked with his father and his brother Charles, and that firm is still around today, and it's been taken over by Roger's son Ben, who also became a CPA and went into the family business. So in addition to the accounting practice, which Roger owned in his own corporation, again, that's called Zazz Inc., he began building spec homes. And he started having problems with the subcontractors, and nothing seemed to be going his way. His marriage broke down in 2004. His mother got a brain tumor and died in 2013.
So wait a minute. He was an accountant. He built homes. Would you believe me if I said he also was a hot air balloon pilot?
What? That's a new one. A CPA full of hot air?
Well, it looks that way. And in fact, he had a business in Arizona, California, Oregon, and Washington, taking passengers up, up and away in a beautiful balloon early in the morning. It was called American Hot Airlines. Can't make that up. He started the business in 1985, and it grew to 5 balloons, which operated in Washington in the summer months and in Arizona during the winter months.
Well, did he have better luck with the hot air balloon company, Tom, than he did with his accounting practice?
Unfortunately not. As you might imagine, piling balloons is a dangerous business. He was in the hot seat in 1987 when he was responsible for a low-flying ballooning incident that caused the death of a quarter horse and injured another horse and a show dog.
Oh man, those poor animals.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, but even worse happened in 1997 when his red, white, and blue balloon piloted by one of his employees hit a tree and dropped its passengers out of the gondola all the way to the ground below.
Oof.
Yeah, it was 7 a.m. They were attempting to land on the edge of an open field, calm conditions. The pilot allowed the balloon to settle into the top of a tree. As the balloon settled into the tree, the gondola tipped to the side and the balloon became snagged. The gondola tipped and the seams on approximately half the balloon burned and ripped, separating the gondola from the balloon. It then fell through the tree and hit the ground. Now, this is very sad. One man who was 70 was killed in the accident, and six others were seriously injured, including spinal injuries.
Ugh, that's horrible. Those hot air balloons are no joke. It kind of pales in comparison to the tax crimes that we're talking about on this show to have somebody actually die from an accident. I'm sure it was an accident, not intended.
Well, it might provide some context into what may have been pressuring Roger when he made some of these really poor decisions. So let's discuss how Roger eventually got caught. Was it because he falsified income information on the loan application?
Well, it's hard to say because this case never got to trial, so we don't really know what ultimately led to the IRS becoming aware of the scheme that was going on with Roger. But I will say that when he filed his 2006 S-Corp tax returns, he got a notice on that in 2009. And a notice that we're all familiar with, that there was not a Form 2553 on file, and there was a request in that notice that he provide it. And so if you've encountered this notice before, you know that that's pretty common to have an S election request get lost or inadvertently fail, particularly during the pandemic and post-pandemic with the shortages in the IRS. A lot of these mail filed 2553 forms are just lost somewhere.
And just to be clear, a taxpayer files Form 2553 when you want to treat your business as an S corporation. So if you don't file this form, you don't have an S corporation.
Right. And procedure actually tells us, because of the timing there, you can go ahead and behave consistently, assuming that you are approved for the S election. But, you know, we're talking about a couple year difference here,
right,
where he's filing the 06 return, let's see, probably an 07. And then, he 2 years later, he gets 09, the notice. So, you know, you can assume that he probably filed 07 and 08
right,
as S corps as well, you know. And so it takes a while for the IRS to kind of recognize what's going on. And so he did. He did file the 08 and the 07 returns on the 1120S form. Now, incidentally, he also claimed the earned income credit on his personal return for one or more of those years in addition. So the underreporting of income fraudulently helped him qualify untruthfully on paper for the cash refunds, you know, that are really there for people who need it, you know, low income.
He severely understated his income and then claimed tax credits that are really meant to help the poor, the poorest among us.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's really hard to say if it was because of the S-Corp election that kind of triggered some additional investigation there, or perhaps it was the earned income credit claim, or I mean, it could be something else altogether. But ultimately, he pled guilty on July 26th of 2016. And in addition to his 15-month prison sentence, he was ordered to pay back $400,000 to the IRS. And of course, he's then going to serve 1 year of supervised release.
Wow, that's a harsh penalty for a major tax crime. What did the authorities have to say about it?
Well, the principal deputy assistant attorney general, who's Caroline Serralo, she's from the Department of Justice's tax division, and she made a statement saying that the department, together with its colleagues in the Internal Revenue Service and other law enforcement partners, will continue to pursue and prosecute those who violate our nation's tax laws.
That's a clear message to anyone who thinks they can bend the tax laws. That's one law the government doesn't play about. I mean, just look at Michael Vick. He didn't spend 3 years in prison for dogfighting. He spent 3 years in prison for tax evasion. So Dominique, what's the lesson here? I know we usually cover that more towards the end, but let's just get into it.
Well, lesson is simple. Always be honest and accurate when it comes to reporting your taxes. But it extends really to filling out any financial form like home loan applications, particularly if you are licensed. The trust and integrity of accountants are crucial to maintaining a functioning tax system. And as we can see from this case, the authorities won't hesitate to bring those who break the law to justice.
You know, I think there's another lesson here as well. Now, you brought up the cobbler's kids having no shoes. This is a reality that, unfortunately, a lot of tax accountants experience. We've both met people who don't even do their own books, own returns, until the last of their clients are submitted. And that can be overwhelming. I think a great lesson here with Roger Stattmuller that he was under an incredible amount of pressure. He's a part owner of a family CPA firm, and that has a lot of stress. But life doesn't stop through tax season for us. There were divorces, there were deaths, there were failed businesses. You know, he really needed to ask for help. That's what I took away from this.
And, you know, that's something that not enough of us are talking about. I imagine the conversation that Roger must have had with his family, his friends, his kids, was that he was going to prison, right? And that's the conversation he had to have. And that one was probably way more difficult to have than a conversation to say, I just can't do it all anymore. I'm overwhelmed. Can someone lend me some support? You know, I've got a man that died in my business. I've got lawsuits from that. I've got I'm just in over my head.
Right.
And even just to hold space for that person to experience the overwhelm and stress, that's something you can do as a friend. That can make things a little less awful at times. I picture Roger being very alone in the things that were occurring in his life. And I'm sure there was immense pressure, given the legacy business that he was involved in, to keep it going, keep everything looking good. And yeah, that's a lot of overwhelm. And because, like all things in life, it ebbs and it flows, and this too shall pass. We hit rough patches, we hit challenges, and simply asking for that bit of support. Again, not somebody necessarily who can come in and save you, although I would love that sometimes. I just want that red phone to call in and say, Batman, come help me.
Yeah, well said. You know, I've seen so many accountants who are otherwise wanting to help their clients stay on the up and up, make poor decisions because of pressure, stress, and not knowing any other way around it. And I think we all just have to realize that we always have at least somebody, I hope, that we can say, I need help. I need help. I need assistance. You know, I need to change something and not go where I'm planning to go.
Absolutely. And again, just knowing that there's someone out there. So reaching out to those in the community, even through social media, I've found has been helpful, Tom, just to commiserate a little bit. And yes, right, we can kind of moan and complain about, you know, the pressures that we're dealing with during the season. And again, it's not about somebody necessarily having the answers or being able to take away that pressure. But, you know, another thing to be learned from this as well is if you've got yourself stretched so thin to the point where you aren't getting essential things done for your own business.
Right.
I can imagine not knowing how I did in the previous year. I'm talking in terms of financial performance. I can't imagine not knowing that until 10 months after the close of the year to get through extension season. But nevertheless, that's what we see a lot. And it's noble to want to help people and get their needs met. But, you know, maybe it's worth taking a hard look and saying, hey, this way that I'm doing this is not sustainable. And I ought to take a look at changing how I'm doing things, because everybody has their breaking point.
Well, Dominique, when you strive to help every single person, but often the person you don't help is yourself.
Yeah, you come last. And it's like they say on the airplane, you have to secure your own mask before you can help those around you. And you know what I always think when they say that, Tom?
What's that?
If I'm traveling with my child, I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to help my child first. The definition of a true codependent, right? No, I've learned now that, you know, you can't be of any help to somebody if you're passed out. So if you do want to help your kid, you do have to be able to put that life mask or the lifeline on. So even just being a lifeline to someone can be just as helpful. And you may never know what's going on behind closed doors, whether it's an air balloon accident or a failed marriage that's very stressful, and dealing with your children and things that come up with kids. Raising kids is hard.
Yeah.
And but again, none of that stops just because of the date on the calendar.
Yeah.
And so managing it all is takes a lot out of those of us in the tax accounting profession. Well, that is our show for today, and it concludes this week's episode of Tax Crime Junkies. We hope you found today's episode informative and eye-opening. The story of Roger Stadtmuller is a stark reminder of the dangers of white-collar crime and how even small amounts of fraudulent activity can have serious consequences. So as always, we urge our listeners to be vigilant and ethical in their financial dealings, and to remember that asking for help might not be as bad as it seems. Thank you for tuning in, and we look forward to bringing you more gripping stories in the world of tax crimes in our next episode.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Take what you learned today and use the truths that hit home to transform the way that you do business. Dominique and I are so grateful you decided to join us today, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and even sharing it with some friends who could use a Tax Crime Junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more. We'll hope you'll join us again next week and continue our mission to find the loopholes that remain open and close them for good. Until next time, remember, every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.